Most people believe teenage girls are more likely to be victims of violence, not perpetrators of it. But what if the cruelest murder in your town wasn't committed by grown men or organized criminals, but by four high school girls in love, in hate, and desperate to belong? On a cold January night in 1992, 12-year-old Shanda Scherer was kidnapped, tortured for hours, and then burned alive in the woods of southern Indiana. Her killers? Two 15-year-olds and two 16-year-olds, girls from seemingly normal homes. One of them brought a teddy bear. Another carried gasoline. The jealousy started over a love triangle. But what happened next spiraled into a kind of group psychosis no one dared explain out loud. Why did no one stop it? Why did some of the girls laugh about it afterward? And why did so many adults, counselors, and even police ignore the warning signs? So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The Girls Who Smiled Through Murder. A tangle of jealousy, innocence, and rage. Shanda Scherer was the kind of 12-year-old who still wrote notes in class, giggled about boys, and wore scrunchies in her hair. Her family had recently moved to New Albany, Indiana, a sleepy Midwestern town where people left their doors unlocked and trusted their neighbors. But on January 10, 1992, that trust would be shattered forever. The story began weeks earlier, in a middle school hallway. Shanda had developed a crush on Amanda Heverin, a slightly older girl with a rebellious streak and a complicated relationship with 16-year-old Melinda Lovelace. Melinda didn't just dislike Shanda, she hated her. Not because of what Shanda had done, but because of what she represented. Vulnerability, youth, and the threat of being replaced. In a twist of adolescent cruelty, Melinda's obsession with Amanda metastasized into a blind, dangerous rage. She stalked Shanda at school, left threatening notes, and told friends she wanted to scare her. But Melinda's idea of scaring would soon involve gasoline, rope, and the charred remains of a child's body in a remote field. The adults in Shanda's life had no idea how close danger was. At 12, Shanda had no enemies, only secrets she didn't know were being weaponized against her. Who were the killers? Melinda Lovelace, 16, was the ringleader. She had a history of violent behavior, was suspended from school multiple times, and had even been hospitalized for suicidal thoughts. Her relationship with Amanda Heverin was possessive and toxic, and Shanda's interest in Amanda triggered a boiling fury. Laurie Tackett, 17, was Melinda's volatile friend, fascinated with witchcraft, death, and the occult. She believed spirits spoke to her and often wrote about demons in her diary. Raised in a strict Pentecostal home, she rebelled violently, once telling classmates she'd kill someone for fun. Hope Rippey, 15, was the quiet accomplice. She came from a chaotic household where violence was common, and although she showed signs of remorse later, on the night of the murder, she laughed. Tony Lawrence, 15, was perhaps the most reluctant. She claimed later that she was horrified, but too scared to intervene. Yet she still got in the car, still helped lure Shanda out of her home, and still watched as the nightmare unfolded. Together they formed one of the most disturbing alliances in American juvenile crime history, a group that embodied not just teen rebellion, but coordinated brutality. The Trap. On the night of January 10, 1992, Tony Lawrence and Hope Rippey knocked on the door of Shanda Scherer's home. They didn't know her well, but they pretended Amanda wanted to see her. Shanda's father, unaware of the deception, allowed her to leave, telling her to be home soon. It was just after 8 p.m. The girls drove Shanda to a remote area near an abandoned house, laughing and joking on the way. But in the back seat, Melinda Lovelace was hiding under a blanket, waiting. When the car stopped, Melinda revealed herself. She pulled out a knife and held it to Shanda's throat. The young girl trembled, begging to go home. But Melinda wasn't ready to kill her. Not yet. They drove Shanda to Laurie Tackett's house. There, the torment escalated. Laurie showed off her room, decorated with demonic symbols and skulls. Shanda, still in her pajamas, was forced to sit and wait. Her fear grew by the minute. But the girls weren't finished, not even close. A night of hell around 2 a.m., they took Shanda to a remote location known as the Witch's Castle, a crumbling ruin that local teens believed was haunted. They forced her out of the car, taunted her, stripped her of her clothes, and tied her up with rope. The temperature that night dropped below freezing. Melinda began beating her. Laurie joined in. Hope and Tony stood by. Some say they tried to intervene. Others say they watched. No one stopped it. But what came next was even more chilling. They shoved Shanda back into the car, drove aimlessly through rural Indiana, then stopped again. This time they took turns stabbing her. They sprayed Windex in her mouth and eyes, telling her it would make her shut up. At one point, Laurie laughed and mimicked Shanda's screams. According to court testimony, she bragged, "You should have heard her, it was hilarious." Bleeding, broken, and barely alive, Shanda was stuffed into the trunk. The stop for breakfast. In a moment that defies belief, the girls drove to a fast food restaurant around dawn. They ordered breakfast. They laughed. Blood was seeping from the trunk. Tony would later say she felt sick, but she didn't leave. None of them did. After eating, they returned to a secluded area. Shanda was still alive, still moaning. They poured gasoline over her broken body and set her on fire. She tried to scream, but by then, her vocal cords were scorched. The flames swallowed her. The cover-up. After the murder, the girls went home and cleaned up. They changed clothes, told lies, and even made jokes. Melinda called Amanda and told her the problem was taken care of, but guilt, real or performative, was already spreading. Tony Lawrence couldn't keep it in. The next day, she told a friend what had happened, that friend's parents contacted police. The investigation moved swiftly. Within 48 hours, all four girls were arrested. When detectives first heard the story, they didn't believe it. Teenage girls don't kill like this, not together, not with this level of planning. But the evidence was overwhelming. Shanda's remains were found in a scorched patch of woods. Her body burned beyond recognition. A coroner would later say that her death was one of the most brutal he had ever seen. The trial that shattered a community. The community of New Albany was stunned. Candlelight vigils turned into protests. People screamed for the death penalty. But the girls were all minors. None would face execution. Instead, prosecutors offered plea deals. The trials were closed to the public, and many details were sealed. Melinda Lovelace and Laurie Tackett received 60-year sentences. Hope Rippey got 35 years. Tony Lawrence, who cooperated early, received 20. For Shanda's family, no sentence was enough. They didn't just kill her, her mother Jackie later said. They tortured her. They took pleasure in it. Shanda's father, Stephen Scherer, never recovered. He died of alcoholism just a few years later. Why did they do it? That question has haunted everyone who followed the case. Was it jealousy, peer pressure, a cult-like influence? Or were these girls simply evil? Psychologists and criminologists debated endlessly. Melinda had suffered sexual abuse. Laurie believed in satanic visions. Hope and Tony were considered followers. But can trauma explain sadism? At what point does a victim become a predator? The girls expressed remorse years later in interviews and court statements, but for many, it rang hollow. Because at the core of this story is a 12-year-old girl who begged for her life, who screamed until she couldn't, who died alone and on fire, while her killers sang along to Madonna in the car. The aftermath and silence. In the months following the murder, school administrators, therapists, and child advocates came under scrutiny. Red flags had been ignored. Melinda had threatened others before. Laurie had once tried to strangle a friend. Hope's family life was violent and unstable. No one connected the dots. No one believed four girls could plan a murder. But they did, and in doing so, they forced America to reconsider everything it thought it knew about teenage. Chapter 2. The Burned Body and the Media Frenzy. The morning she didn't come home. January 11, 1992. The sun rose cold and sharp over Jefferson County, Indiana, casting its weak winter light over farmland, woodlands, and a narrow stretch of gravel road near a place called Lemon Road. A passing motorist saw what at first looked like a pile of charred debris. Maybe trash? Maybe a bonfire? It wasn't. It was a human body, blackened beyond recognition. arms curled, up in a final reflex of agony, legs pulled to the chest, skin peeled away in flakes and clumps, teeth cracked, the stench of scorched flesh still hung in the air, even hours later when crime scene technicians arrived. Shandar Renee Scherer hadn't come home. Her mother Jackie called police in a panic. She knew something was wrong. Shandar wasn't the type of girl to run away or sneak out. She still slept with a teddy bear. The body was too far gone to identify on sight. No one wanted to say it, but in their hearts, every officer, every coroner, every neighbor already knew. It was Shandar. The shocking confession. The case broke wide open, not because of forensics, but because of guilt, or something close to it. Within 48 hours of the murder, 15-year-old Toni Lawrence cracked. She walked into the Jefferson County Sheriff's Department, shaking, and gave a statement that chilled even hardened investigators. She described the kidnapping, the knife, the rope, the burning body. She named the girls, Melinda Lovelace, Laurie Tackett, Hope Rippey. Detectives didn't want to believe it. Four girls, all under 18, all from middle-class families. One of them, Hope, had just come back from a church trip. Another, Melinda, had cried at school talent shows, but the details Toni shared were too specific to be fabricated. Police arrested Melinda Lovelace first. She showed no emotion. Then Laurie. Then Hope. The community of New Albany began to tremble. There were no boys involved, no older men, no drugs or gang initiations. Just four girls, a 12-year-old victim, and a story that would soon capture national attention. Media madness news vans rolled into Indiana by the dozen. Every anchor from Dateline to 2020 wanted the exclusive. The headline practically wrote itself. Teen girls torture and burn, 12-year-old alive. People compared it to the Manson murders, others to Lord of the Flies. The public demanded answers. How could young girls commit something this vile? What was happening in America's youth? The press dug into the girls' pasts, eager to find the signs missed by parents and teachers. Melinda's home life was chaotic. Her father, Larry Lovelace, was a known child molester and abuser. He had molested Melinda and her sisters for years before vanishing. Laurie Tackett's life was equally unstable. Her mother was ultra-religious, her father abusive. Laurie had been hospitalized for hallucinations and once attempted suicide. Friends recalled her talking about satanic rituals and wearing blood around her neck, for protection. Hope Rippey had been caught in the undertow of it all, impressionable, eager to belong, and willing to follow. But none of it, no trauma, no background, explained the deliberate cruelty of what they did to Shandar Scherer. Inside the courtroom. Despite public outcry for the death penalty, the state of Indiana chose not to pursue it. All four girls were juveniles, and executing minors was controversial, even in 1992. Instead, prosecutors focused on airtight plea deals and detailed confessions. Melinda Lovelace and Laurie Tackett, the ringleaders, were both sentenced to 60 years in prison. Hope Rippey, who showed signs of remorse, received 35 years. Toni Lawrence, who had confessed first and seemed genuinely traumatized, received 20 years. There was no open trial. No public testimony. Most of the court records were sealed to protect juvenile privacy. For Shandar's family, this felt like justice in a locked box. Her mother, Jackie Vaught, later said, "They didn't want the world to hear what they did, but we heard. We'll never forget." The letters, the laughter, the lack of remorse. In prison, Melinda Lovelace was often described as charismatic. She made friends easily, took up writing, sang in the prison choir. Some guards even liked her. But there were troubling signs. In letters later obtained by Shandar's family, Melinda joked about smoking that bitch. Referring to the night of the murder, she described fire as purifying. She referred to Shandar as the problem. Laurie Tackett was just as chilling. In interviews with psychologists, she described the murder in flat, disconnected tones, like she was describing a horror movie. She said it didn't feel real, and admitted she laughed while Shandar screamed. Hope Rippey expressed sorrow in letters to Shandar's mother, but even her remorse seemed slippery. She claimed she didn't know it would go that far. Yet she had bought the lighter fluid. Only Toni Lawrence seemed to grasp the gravity from the beginning. She wept during interviews. She tried to get out of the car that night. She turned the others in, but she still watched as Shanda was tortured, still sat silently as the others laughed. The parole board would later note, all four girls had choices. None of them made the right one. A mother's pain, a father's destruction. No one suffered more than Shanda's parents. Jackie Vortscherer became a fierce advocate for victims' rights. She attended every parole hearing. She read letters to the court describing the pain of burying a 12-year-old whose body was so burned she could only be identified by dental records. She once said, "I had to say goodbye to a box of ash. That's what they left me." Stephen Scherer, Shanda's father, never recovered. He spiraled into alcoholism and depression. He died a few years after Shanda, unable to cope. Their marriage ended. The grief swallowed them both. Friends say Jackie once tried to forgive, tried to believe that young girls can make deadly mistakes, but the cruelty, so planned, so prolonged, made forgiveness impossible. The release of the killers. By 2018, all four girls had been released from prison. Tony Lawrence was released in 2000 after serving just 9 years. Hope Rippey was released in 2006 after serving 14 years. Laurie Tackett was released in 2018 after serving 26 years. Melinda Lovelace, the one who held the knife, poured the gasoline, and gave the order, was released in September 2019, 27 years after the murder. She walked out a free woman. At her final parole hearing, she read a statement expressing regret. "I take responsibility," she said. "I think about Shanda every day." But outside, protesters held signs that read, "Life for a life. No parole for child killers. Justice denied." Jackie Scherer refused to attend that final hearing. She had said all she needed to say. "Melinda can have her second chance," she told reporters. "Shanda never got one." What we still don't understand. The Shanda Scherer murder case has been studied by criminologists, psychologists, and sociologists for decades. It shattered every stereotype about female aggression. Girls, the world learned, are just as capable of sadism. But it also raised deeper questions. How did four girls coordinate a killing without anyone saying no? Were they victims of trauma or willing monsters? Would this have happened if one of them had simply said, "Stop"? Experts disagree. Some point to groupthink, a psychological phenomenon where individuals abandon their morals to conform to the group. Others point to the warped power dynamic between Melinda and the others. She was older, more manipulative, more cruel. Still others say the girls wanted to feel powerful, wanted to taste the forbidden. But what they did wasn't just about rage. It was performance, control, a rehearsed horror show where no one screamed, "Cut." The forgotten warning signs. In the aftermath, school counselors came forward with chilling admissions. Melinda had been on suicide watch before. Laurie had bragged about dreams of stabbing people. Hope was frequently suspended. Tony had been bullied and ignored. One teacher remembered a disturbing poem Melinda wrote about fire and bones. Another recalled Laurie sketching satanic symbols in the margins of her math test. But no one had connected the dots. And no one warned Shanda. The system failed. Again. The girl who never came back. Shanda Scherer would be 44 years old today. She might have been a mother, a teacher, a nurse, a poet. Instead, her name lives in true crime documentaries, victim advocacy forums, and every dark tale about girls who kill. She was only 12. She wanted to kiss a girl. She wanted to dance at the school gym. She wanted to see her friends. She didn't know that a teenage feud had turned into a death sentence. Her death didn't just expose four murderers. It exposed a broken culture that overlooks signs, minimizes girl-on-girl violence, and still whispers drama when it should scream danger.